court is ready to hear arguments from petitioner L. Bayor versus Smith.
The Supreme Court, John Paul Davis, the argument of the petitioner, David, would attend the
court. May it please the court. The first point of error in this appeal raises the question of whether Mary Carter agreements violate public policy. The trial in this case was not a fair adversary proceeding. The reason it was not fair was because two settling defendants who had confessed liability for the plaintiff's injuries, the respondent's injuries, Mrs. Smith, helped her present her case against another defendant, Dr. James Elbaugh, the petitioner, in exchange for Ms. Smith's agreement to pay the two settling defendants up to $375,000 out of the recovery that Ms. Smith obtained against Dr. Elbaugh.
How did that help manifest itself?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
How did the help manifest itself?
That help, Your Honor, first of all, there's a whole litany of things that attorneys for the settling defendants did, as well as the attorney for the plaintiff did in this case, to distort the proceedings. One of the things, for instance, Ms. Smith's own witnesses testified to evidence which established Dr. Serkin's fault and, in fact, showed him to be a highly culpable party. Contrary to that testimony, however, Ms. Smith's attorneys argued that Dr. Serkin was a hero, that he saved her foot, that he did nothing to cause Ms. Smith's injury, and in fact saved her life and saved her ankle. The plaintiff's attorneys, Ms. Smith's attorneys, also argued that all of her damages could have been avoided but for Dr. Elbaugh's negligence. Another way in which the unfairness manifested itself in the trial was the manner in which the settling parties made arguments designed to increase the damage award, the settling defendants' attorneys in particular. One of the attorneys for the settling defendants described Ms. Smith's damages during voir dire as devastating, astoundingly high, and astronomical. Another defense counsel told the jury, in effect, to put themselves in the plaintiff's shoes. In addition to that, while they were questioning the witnesses, the settling defendants' attorneys followed up on some of the questioning of the plaintiff's attorney, Ms. Smith's attorney, and to draw out testimony on damages and so forth. In effect, Ms. Smith had four lead counsel in this case. Another manner in which the unfairness manifested itself in this case was the fact that the settling defendants all had pleadings on file which alleged that Ms. Smith was not entitled to the full amount of her damages. The settling defendants, however, as I pointed out just a moment ago, argued vigorously during trial that Ms. Smith should receive all of the damages that her attorneys had asked for. There was also evidence in the record which would have allowed the jury to make a lower damage finding. There was evidence that a good deal of Ms. Smith's damage was the result of the trauma of the initial injury itself and not from any alleged malpractice. Nevertheless, counsel, for instance, from Dr. Serkin, during final argument, told the jury that he had the obligation to talk on behalf of Ms. Smith, and he told the jury that he felt it was his responsibility to urge that they award Ms. Smith all of her damages that she's asked for. He then passed
the note. You were able to cross-examine the witnesses at whatever length you wanted to about the extent to which the agreement may
Your Honor.
Bias their testimony, and I assume you got an ample chance on final argument. Point out the unusualness of these proceedings.
We did have an opportunity to do that, Your Honor, and trial counsel did the best they could. However, our objection at trial was that there was no means to eliminate the prejudice and harm that the Mary Carter arrangement posed in this case, and that disclosure itself of the agreements for the purpose of discrediting the witnesses, impeaching the witnesses, for whatever purpose disclosure could be used for, was not a sufficient means to eliminate the prejudice that resulted in this trial.
Why is that? Why didn't the jury get an accurate picture of how the lineup of the parties, how it stacks up by disclosing the contents of the agreement, that some defendants have an interest in jacking up the damages and things of that nature? Why doesn't that ameliorate any harm to the adversary process?
Well, Your Honor, as Justice Spears and Gonzalez pointed out in their concurrence in Smithwick, the disclosure of the Mary Carter agreement itself generates its own form of prejudice. Most juries are not sophisticated enough, we don't believe, to evaluate the various posturing of the parties in the case. The disclosure of the Mary Carter agreement could, in effect, well, as it was used in this case, the disclosure was used to suggest that Dr. Elbar was unreasonable in resisting settlement. So, in fact, disclosure didn't help Dr. Elbar, it only hurt him. Disclosure of the settlement agreement may also, in certain cases, be used to infer that the plaintiff has been paid all of her damages, that the culpable party has come forward and the plaintiff has received full satisfaction. The problem with the disclosure of traditional settlement agreements still exists when you disclose a Mary Carter agreement. That is, a jury may believe that the settlement agreement itself is an admission of liability on the part of the settling defendant. In fact, that happened in a case in Washington. And that case is, I believe, reported at 514 Pacific 2nd, 17. In that case, the jury returned a verdict against the settling defendant and exonerated the non-settling defendant, and the plaintiff on appeal alleged that the disclosure of the agreement prejudiced his case because it led the jury to believe that the settling defendant was the more culpable party. So those are the reasons why we don't believe disclosure is an adequate means of eliminating the prejudice of a Mary Carter agreement. The courtroom tactics and the disingenuous argument that was used by the settling parties in this case was designed clearly to persuade the jury to disregard or discount evidence which established the culpability of one of the settling defendants, Dr. Serkin. The evidence which showed that Ms. Smith herself may have been responsible for some of her own damages, and to persuade the jury to put all the blame on Dr. Elbar. The combination of tactics and arguments which counsel for the settling parties used in this case so skewed the presentation of the case to the jury that Dr. Elbar was denied a fair trial. The problems that this case presents to the court are nothing new. 15 years ago in General Motors versus Simmons, the court recognized the fact that Mary Carter agreements damaged the integrity and the adversary nature of trial proceedings. Shortly thereafter, the court in Smith and Scurlock versus Smithwick, a majority of the court acknowledged that Mary Carter agreements have a tendency to prejudice the fairness of trials. And as I noted a moment ago, Justice Spears and Justice Gonzalez wrote a detailed opinion, a concurring opinion in that case, outlining all the problems of Mary Carter's. More recently, in Beach Aircraft versus Jenkins, the court held that an agreement which allowed the settling defendant to prosecute the plaintiff's claims against a non-settling defendant violated public policy for essentially the same reasons that we have alleged the Mary Carter agreements in this case should be declared void for public policy reasons. The court in that case cited as reasons for prohibiting those types of agreements that those type of agreements do not promote full settlement of cases, and they engender a courtroom distortion of the nature that the record shows that occurred in this case.
You pointed out in your brief, two or three states, I believe it's three, have outlawed Mary Carter agreements.
Yes, Your Honor.
How many states have passed on this issue?
Your Honor,
you admit it's a minority, but I don't think...
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I wanted to make a point this morning that there's a lot said about the majority of courts upholding Mary Carter agreements. In fact, it's really there's a majority of courts have decided the question that have upheld Mary Carter agreements. And by my count, Your Honor, there's been only four cases that have actually ruled on that question. It's not quite correct to say that the majority of courts in the United States have upheld Mary Carter agreements. The courts that have the reasons that they've cited, one of the most common reasons that the courts that have upheld Mary Carter agreements is consistent with public policy, have cited the law favors settlement as being the main reason to uphold Mary Carter agreements. Actually, the law does favor settlement, but the law does not favor Mary Carter agreements. A Mary Carter agreement is essentially a partial settlement. The whole purpose and objective of the Mary Carter agreement is to continue the litigation against the non-settling defendant to maximize the recovery of the parties to that agreement. But even in cases in which a Mary Carter agreement may possibly encourage a non-settling defendant to settle and thereby affect a full settlement of the case, I think the court needs to look at the question of whether Mary Carter agreements encourage settlement in a manner that's fair to all parties. Mary Carter agreements have been observed by most scholars as being most attractive to the more culpable party. Because of the potential for unfairness in the trials involving Mary Carter agreements, a plaintiff and a settling defendant put themselves in a position where they can effectively coerce the non-settling defendant to either settle the case, in some cases at a much higher price, or to litigate and risk the burden of a judgment that was obtained through an unfair proceeding. In either scenario, the settling defendant in a Mary Carter situation obtains a form of contribution from the non-settling defendant by the recoupment of settlement money that they paid out of the plaintiff's recovery against the non-settling defendant. There are some commentators and courts that have attempted to legitimize Mary Carter agreements on the basis that they simplify litigation. They don't simplify litigation in this state. A settling defendant's liability under our contribution schemes is still an issue in trial, so even when settling defendants settle with the plaintiff, their liability may still be an issue in the trial. More importantly, Mary Carter agreements effectively complicate trials. The existence of the Mary Carter agreement itself, as this case demonstrates, and the impact that it has on the parties just becomes an additional issue at trial that the court and the jury have to deal with. So Mary Carter agreements do not simplify litigation.
from the cases and the commentators that you cited, are you able to give at least a generalized answer as to how common these agreements are?
In the state of Texas, Your Honor?
Yes.
I would say that's hard to say. I'd be speculating, but based on my experience, they're fairly common.
So a ruling in this case will have that Mary Carter agreements are invalid will have pretty far-reaching consequences.
A ruling in this case, and let me back up and say they are fairly common in multi-party tort litigation, but a ruling in this case will be significant in terms of the impact that it's going to have on a lot of pending lawsuits. I know of a couple of lawyers in Fort Worth who have not yet got to the trial stage and have struck Mary Carter agreements.
Since the last time the court spoke on this, it was 7-2, it was pretty clear. If the court were to change its mind, why shouldn't the ruling be prospective only?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I view this as a case of first impression. Judge Pope in Simmons stated that the court had never ruled on the validity of Mary Carter agreements. Justice Spears, joined by Justice Gonzalez, made that same observation in Reliance on Simmons. The court has never squarely addressed the question of the validity of Mary Carter agreements. Secondly, the concurrence in Smithwick, along with the cases that have criticized Mary Carter agreements and the unanimous scholarly criticism we submit, have put the bar on notice that these agreements, there's always been the potential that these agreements may be declared void against public policy. Thirdly,
is it your position in that regard that basically it was foreseeable this court would invalidate Mary Carter agreements?
Yes, sir. I do believe that based on the...
That's based exclusively on Simmons and on Scurlock against Smithwick and the fact that the commentators don't like them?
It's based on Simmons. It's based on the City of Houston case in which Judge Pope discussed the unfairness of the trial in that case, remanded it for new trials. Based on Smithwick versus Scurlock observation. It's based on the concurrence of Justice Gonzalez and Justice Spears in that opinion. It's based on two or three courts of appeals opinions in which the courts have deferred the question of whether they violate public policy to this court. And courts of appeals do not generally defer questions of that nature unless there's some uncertainty in the law. And our position is that their legality has always been uncertain, and that the policy argument that attorneys and litigants in the state of Texas have relied on precedent or have relied on a rule just doesn't fly in this case. There's nothing upon which parties have relied on except perhaps the fact that the court has not yet had an opportunity to address it, and so by the mere fact that the court hadn't addressed it, then it must be something that's okay for the time being. But
what about the reliance? The court did have an opportunity in Smithwick, but the majority of the court chose not to.
What about the argument that they did have an opportunity,
yes,
but they chose not to?
That's right.
Well, Your Honor, the only way I can address this is...
Doesn't that cut against you? And for the argument of prospectivity?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The court in Watkins, I can't remember the full style, it's cited in briefs on the question of retrospective application. The court in that case, I believe, had an opportunity to declare the doctrine of charitable immunity, to abrogate that doctrine. Yet it didn't at that particular time, but there were concurrences in that opinion in which justices on the court at that time declared to the public that they were ready to declare that the doctrine of charitable immunity should be abrogated. I don't know whether the question was presented in Smithwick. But if it was, I still submit that the fact that there's been so much uncertainty that's been recognized by the courts of this state, and this court itself has said that it has never squarely addressed the issue, gives nothing for litigants to rely on. One final time's up.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. The court is ready to hear all you want from respond.
If it pleases the court, I'm here today with George Dixie, who is the trial lawyer who tried this case. The reason Mr. Dixie is here is, of course, to answer any questions the court might have about the trial of the case. Let me tell you, I think the issue is squarely cut here, and that is whether the court wishes to declare Mary Carter agreements, whatever those agreements might be, void as against public policy. We believe the court should not do it. We believe that there are valid reasons for upholding Mary Carter agreements. And in that regard, I want to read to you from the majority opinion in Scurlock Oil. And I think that's important because I do think the court, at least the majority, addressed the issue of public policy. And I will admit that this is out of context, but it comes from page 7 and is a quote. Notwithstanding, and that was after a passage in which the majority author had discussed the bad parts of, or what he thought the dangers, and he used the word potential dangers of Mary Carter agreements was, he said, notwithstanding, for public policy reasons, we permit Mary Carter agreements in spite of the potential skewing of a non-settling defendant's liability. I think the court has directly addressed this very recently, and as a result, I think you have seen the reliance of the courts of appeals around the state on that opinion. Mr. Casey said one thing that I think is true. There's no doubt in the Simmons case that the court then said, and that was back in 72, that the validity of Mary Carter agreements had not been directly addressed by this court. However, that issue was joined in Scurlock Oil. I just read you what the majority said, and since that period of time, there have been three cases which have cited Scurlock for that proposition. It is important to note that the trial court in this case, when passing on the Mary Carter agreement, cited the Supreme Court precedent saying that's what he was following, although his personal desires might be different, quite frankly. I think that you should know that the position that we take in this case is that Mary Carter agreements, properly monitored and a trial properly monitored, do not create any problem with public policy. Let me tell you why. The property code passed by the legislature, who is the arbiter of public policy in this state, has said causes of actions may be assigned and sold with no restriction. I think the court's only view into this then is what happens at the trial. And I think it's important to look at the facts of this case to determine what actually was done.
Assuming the court agrees with you, Mr. Keltner, should the court take this opportunity to be specific about the safeguards that the trial court ought to implement in order to prevent the skewing of the adversary process?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that would clear up an unclear part of the law. However, I will tell you that I think the court has a very good guideline for doing that. And it is Justice Spears and Justice Gonzalez's dissent in Scurlock. That's what this judge used and almost specifically says it. And in fact, if you look even at his order, he goes down and isolates what he's going to do. Now,
you mean the jury instructions?
Yes, sir. He did a number of things here, and I think it's important for everybody to understand that. First off, let me tell you that there are only two points where there are objections made in the record, arguably three, about Mary Carter agreements. And I think that's important to this case because of the court's per curiam opinion in the Stein case that was before you even more recently than Scurlock. The first is a motion to dismiss settling defendants was made at a pretrial conference. This is not a hidden Mary Carter agreement. It was disclosed by the plaintiff before pretrial conferences. One of the agreements was also disclosed before it was even completed. So the judge had a good opportunity to address the entire issue. And here's what the judge did. He first said, on stripes, here's what we're going to do. The settling defendants and plaintiffs get six strikes, and the non-settling defendants get six. Second, I'm going to tell the jury, and he did tell the jury in the voir dire examination about the Mary Carter agreements without any of the self-serving language. And what he said essentially was that these defendants have a financial interest and stand to get all of their money back if the plaintiff succeeds at a substantial level. Well, the interesting thing there was he actually went too far, because that is not what the Mary Carter Agreement says specifically is to Arlington Community Hospital. Nonetheless, he went forward. He changed the order of the parties, as suggested in the concurring opinion, so that Dr. Elbar would have the right to finish and close and clean up and rebut anything the settling defendants said. Next, he changed the order of closing and opening argument to do the same thing. He also left without any limitation whatsoever Dr. Elbar's lawyers to cross-examine any witness on the issue of their financial interest in the case, and they did so. And I'll tell you the most telling thing on this is the final arguments. I urge you to read it. It's 120 pages long, and it is the arguments of all the parties, and it tells the story. What happens is that a substantial period of time is taken up by the defendants, defendant Dr. Elbar, in talking about the financial interest. It got through to the jury. Some of the things that the petitioner now complains of are the same things I rely on to say the jury was not duped. It is true that the settling defendant's lawyers got up and said, I am arguing for Carol Smith. What could be more honest to the jury?
In their pleadings, they had taken a contrary position.
Sir?
In their pleadings, they had taken a contrary position.
Absolutely true, Your Honor, but their argument is that the jury was somehow duped by that. The real truth of the matter is the jury couldn't be duped. And I think the jury's answers to special issues, when you compare them to the argument, are very telling here. Specifically,
but the jury argument is not the only complaint. They're complaining about the tag team approach in questioning the witnesses.
Yes, sir, and I think and that makes some sense, except for the fact that in a case, and I want you to consider the opposite, or really the conclusion they're urging you to. They say their essential fallback argument is Mary Carter agreements, one, ought to be voided. Second, if they're not, keep the settling defendants out of trial. Well, of course a defendant wants that, because under the current statute, what would happen is they get to argue to somebody who is not there what their negligence is, so they can't protect themselves. And a plaintiff then has to artificially do the same thing they now claim the defendant does. Equally unfair. Equally unfair, if not more so. It's also interesting, Your Honor, to note two things. I mean, one important thing. This case was tried under the comparative negligence statute, not the comparative responsibility statute. That's an important question. We're not going to have any more of those cases. This accident occurred in 1985. It is important that there had to be a cross-action, or at least the law was somewhat disputed on that, and we don't have to face that issue anymore, I hope. But in any event, had to file cross-actions in order to get that submitted, and that's what Dr. Elbar did. Again, I want you to focus, if I could, again on the argument. Here's what happened. There were three answers the plaintiff and the settling defendants asked the jury to give. Only three. One is $500,000 in damages, $2.5 million of that in punitive. What did the jury do? Gave no punitive damages and gave less than half that amount as actual damages. It's interesting to note, by the way, under the Mary Carter agreements, the settling plaintiffs got no reduction for any punitive findings.
Settling defendants.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, the settling defendants. Next thing that they argued is that Dr. Serkin be found to be negligent, but that his negligent not cause would not be proximate cause of the injuries. What did the jury find? Exactly the opposite. They found negligence, and they found it was a proximate cause. The third thing, and only other thing that was argued to the jury by the plaintiffs and settling defendants, was that there be no percentage of negligence assigned to Dr. Serkin. And what did they do? They found 12%. This jury wasn't due. The only objection that they mention a number of things today to you in argument. They mention, for example, Jenkins. never raised till appeal.
Well, let's talk about Jenkins.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree with the holding of Jenkins?
Oh, Your Honor. No, sir, I do not.
Can you swear Jenkins?
Justice Maljay, I'm sorry. You set me up on that one. I do not, Your Honor.
Can you swear Jenkins with Smith and Sturlock? Smith, whatever that is. Our latest writing.
It is difficult. Let me. I think tell you my theories on this, and I have thought long and hard about it. I think pragmatism in the law is one of the most extremely important things we have. The problems with Jenkins, and again, Justice Maljay, I apologize, is that it is. I think Jenkins probably discourages more settlements than it encourages. And the real truth of the matter is, if you go to CLE events around the state, you'll hear very good lawyers saying you can't settle if a lot of cases because of it. But on the other hand, I don't think Jenkins controls this. And I think we win if Jenkins is good law, and it certainly is good law. We win for this reason. In Jenkins, Justice Maljay, I think, was very specific in what he said, and I think it makes great sense. And in that respect, a very pragmatic opinion. The plaintiff can't sell all of their cause of action to somebody else so they can continue litigation. Also, inherent in Jenkins, in the Jenkins opinion, and what I think the petitioner has been relying on, is the idea that the other party could control what happened and control settlement. In other words, the settling defendant. Not what happened here. And let me tell you, we have some precedents on this, and it's Bass versus Phoenix Seadrift, which was decided by the Fifth Circuit. And what the Fifth Circuit held is, if the settling defendant has no veto power over the plaintiff's cause of action, and there was none here in any of these agreements, then there's no real problem. This is not a wholesale assignment of a cause of action. It does not fall under Jenkins. It is not contribution. And as a result, I think that even if Jenkins, let me say it differently, Jenkins remains good law, and we are not harmed at all by Jenkins. Again, I will tell you, this argument was never raised to the trial court. It came for the first time on at the Court of Appeals.
Jenkins does not say that a defendant cannot sell his entire cause of action to a plaintiff, does it?
No, sir. It says it the other way around. Yes, sir.
It's done all the time.
That's right. Done constantly, and is the way we settle a lot of these lawsuits. Again, I want to emphasize to you that the result that the petitioner urges on you will allow one side of the docket to point at an empty chair and say, those people did it in their absence. They get to shoot folks in the back. I hope that's not the Texas way. Let me also tell you is, I think, and it is our position, that Texas juries are sophisticated enough to see through these things. In this case, we know they did, because their answers are not what the settling defendants wanted and were not what the plaintiffs wanted. Let me also tell you several other things. The petitioner has complained today and in their briefs significantly about the fact of oral argument. It was not objected to. To the cross-examining of witnesses, it was not objected to. And to...
Was there a request for a running objection?
Sir?
Was there any running objection?
No, sir. And let me explain in that regard what happened. And I'm going to ask my counsel, I'm absolutely right about that. I am all right. All right. This is the way it happened, and I don't want to paint this picture for the court. There is no doubt in the pretrial conference that the petitioner did make the argument that Mary Carter's were void as against public policy, and alternatively asked that the settling defendants not be allowed to participate in the court. They did that in an effort to preserve error. Thereafter, in the pre-hearing conference, when the judge was setting up the various protections he was going to use, they once again said, see, Judge, this may not work. The next complaint on the grounds of Mary Carter agreement was not until the motion for new trial. I think under Stein, and remember what happened in Stein, this court in a per curiam opinion decided that issue and said since the Mary Carter agreement, when it came into evidence, there was no objection, nothing is preserved, and we do not reach the issue. Your Honor,
I can't recall in Stein, had there been prior objections during pretrial proceedings?
Yes, sir. In fact, in the Stein case, what had happened, and the Court of Appeals opinion makes this clear, in Stein, the whole fight at the trial court had been over the Mary Carter agreement and what it meant. The problem the Court of Appeals had to address was it was an unsigned copy, and no one realized it until after the trial was over. And it's really sort of a fascinating comedy of errors. Your Honor, one of the other things I think that you will have to look at when you get into this case is the problem of opening this up. We're going to be opening up the theory of freedom to contract. We're then going to have to make a determination of what's a Mary Carter agreement and what's not.
You say that, but explain why that's so complicated. I thought it was any situation where the defendant still owned a piece of the cause of action, that is to change the number.
But, Your Honor, even in that definition, I think problems come up. It probably has been put by the scholars in this, and I know there are a lot of law review articles on it. Interestingly, a lot of law reviews are very critical of Mary Carter agreements. Fascinatingly, CLE articles presented to lawyers outside of the academic purview are not. And I take great exception to the idea that the commentators are almost unanimously against it. Not true. Practicing lawyers are not, because it works out to settle cases. But addressing your question directly, Your Honor, the traditional notion has been...
Before you move from that statement, you said it really settles cases. What does it settle? You're still going to go to trial.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
The dynamics change, but you're still going to have a trial. You don't save a trial by Mary Carter agreement.
Your Honor, that has been used and is obviously part of the concurring opinion that you and Justice Spears wrote. I think that is a little bit of an oversimplification, if you will. And I think that for two reasons. First off, no one in this state, and I don't think this court would want to hold that partial settlements are against public policy for any reason. It's just in the abstract. Settle and they're out. No one would want to do that. Second, and the case continues, same thing in a Mary Carter agreement, except with some different interests. I think additionally, Mary Carter agreements, you don't see many of them that reach the appellate level. There are some, but not many. There are a lot out there, and there are a lot of public, and in fact, you have an amicus brief filed by Jim Cromser that indicates his interest in one. We've been contacted by numerous lawyers on others, but the truth of the matter is not really very many of them reach the appellate level, and most of it because is once Mary Carter agreement's entered, there's a settlement. Let me take exception with what the petitioner said. He said that the commentators say, and it's true, especially outside Texas, that the traditional wisdom is you settle with the most culpable defendant and get them to help you against the least culpable. I don't think that's what the evidence is in this case. Let me tell you, the Court of Appeals didn't think so. And in that regard, let me say two things very quickly about the state of the evidence. The evidence in this case was highly controverted. Dr. Elbar claimed that every other doctor, almost, not everyone, but the majority of the doctors in the case that treated Mrs. Smith were negligent. And he claimed that before the Mary Carter agreements and afterwards. He said that Dr. Serkin, who I think it is undisputed, saved Mrs. Smith's life on the initial treatment, was negligent. And by the way, they say there's really no evidence of that. Three times in the final arguments, attorneys for Dr. Elbar say that Dr. Serkin saved Mrs. Smith's life. He also says that people on his own team treating at Arlington Community Hospital were negligent. He also says Dr. Burkhead, who is at Southwestern Medical School, who treated her after, was negligent. He also claimed that he infers the two of those people committed perjury in order to save their own selves. I said that in an improper way. Forgive me, but I'm from Fort Worth. But I think that's important because this was the type of litigation that he was involved in, and I think that most Mary Carter agreements these days, especially in Texas, aren't settled with the most culpable defendant. They're settled with the least culpable.
Is there any scholarly study of that?
No, sir, and I...
Provable thing to prove, of course.
No, sir, there's not, and I've looked for one.
Now, back to my question of 5 or 6 minutes ago. Why is it so difficult for a court to come up with a definition of what a Mary Carter agreement is?
Your Honor, the traditional wisdom is that a Mary Carter agreement is an agreement in which a settling defendant has some financial interest in the plaintiff's cause of action. If that's the agreement, that might be one. If that's the definition, that might be one thing. Let me tell you, the Fifth Circuit would disagree with that. The Fifth Circuit looks upon, and this is Bass versus Phoenix Cedro, what Bass says is a Mary Carter agreement is not only that, but when the defendant controls what happens by a veto power over any settlement. Also, what about a settlement in which someone...
You could see that that's probably... But that has greater problems.
Much greater problems, Your Honor, and problems that do carry it much, much closer to the edge. But that's not what we're talking about here. And Justice Phillips, Chief Justice Phillips, the reason I mention that is we get into matters of degree here. Additionally, let me suggest that there are other situations in which there is a settlement, the settling defendant is completely released, and there are agreements behind the scenes, sometimes disclosed, which would apportion monies for future recoveries. Are those Mary Carter agreements? Well, some states they are. We would not have considered them Mary Carter agreements in Texas, but perhaps we would. And again, no public policy against those. They settle part of the case.
Are you aware of any literature about problems at discovering the existence of Mary Carter agreements? There's one firm, one prominent firm in Texas that at least used to have seminars on how to not perjure yourself by answering questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
That people would not find out that there were agreements.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm aware of that, and that's unfortunate.
Have you been to one of these?
That's unfortunate and not the kind of thing I think we want to encourage in Texas.
But I mean, your argument depends on full and fair disclosure of any deal that skews the natural tendencies,
yes, sir,
of a party. And how, if the court decides to allow this freedom of contract, how can we further ensure that that's done? That if there are any secret deals to share strikes all the way up to the Mary Carter or all the way up to a Bass type of situation?
Your Honor, I think you've already done it. There is no doubt that Mary Carter agreements are discoverable, and that is an exception to the general rule. Additionally, after Spurlock Oil came out, the rules were changed, saying that agreements in other cases could be discoverable. And I think it doesn't say agreements in other cases. I think it's just limited to agreements. I think they are discoverable now. I think under the continuing duty to report, a lawyer would violate the code, would violate the rules of procedure, and arguably the Code of Professional Responsibility by not responding. And I think they are fully discoverable now. I am not arguing for a system that would put these in shadows. I'm arguing for a system that puts full light on them, and that's what happened in this case.
Despite your contention that many of these Mary Carter agreements will lead to settlement completely at somewhere along the judicial pipeline, if we rule against you here, are we going to be affecting a large number of cases that are going through the pipeline now?
Yes, sir, an incredible number. And I think that is one of the reasons that if the court should feel a reason to declare Mary Carter agreements void against public policy, I would ask you to do two things. And I hope you don't, I truly hope you don't reach that issue, and I feel you don't need to. First is to define what Mary Carter agreement means as narrowly as possible. Second, and I think this is truly important, it has to be prospective in application. The quote that I read you from Spurlock Oil, especially taken together with the concurrence, has been read by practitioners, and you can see it in the cases, and the courts of appeals and trial judges in this case, as approving Mary Carter agreements. The quote here says, we permit them because of public policy. If you're going to change it, it has got to be prospective. I ask you to think about the multi-defendant cases in which minors might be involved that could be attacked for years to come. Again, I think that the court has done that recently and wisely in Mosier and
Reagan versus Vaughn.
Yes, sir, Reagan versus Vaughn, Hudson versus FDIC, which I think is probably the clearest writing on that issue. And I think it's imperative that it's going to affect a huge number of cases in which lawyers and clients have no way to protect themselves thereafter. In this case, for example, it would have a huge difference. Contrary to what the petitioner says, there is a severability clause in one of the Mary Carter agreements here, but not in another. How are we going to handle something like that? It's very difficult, and especially it's going to affect contract rights, something this court has been loath to do.
And if, on the other hand, the court agrees with you about the merits of your contentions, you feel there's really not much more that needs to be written by us concerning standards for trial court handling the Mary Carter agreement?
No, sir, not much more. In deference to Justice X's question, I think a lot is in the concurrence in Spurlock Oil. That may need to become into a majority opinion, but I think that essentially solves the problem.
Mr. Keltner, the parties write the contract, and the course of legal proceedings, is it unlimited in your view?
Your Honor, our problem is that the property code says that you can assign or sell a cause of action. That is the public policy of the state.
How is that different from, I can't recall which of the McElhaney cases it was, but where a party settles and in essence sells his expert witnesses to the other party, who then designates them as consulting only experts rather than testifying experts?
Your Honor, I think it differs substantially. Let me also say the second part of my answer to you has to your original question has to be this. I think the court has inherent authority to control what happens before the court and how cases are presented to the jury. So I think the court has some power in that regard, and I would be less than candid with you if I did not admit that.
Now, how is McElhaney different?
Why I think McElhaney is different.
Why is that just capitalism in action?
Innovative capitalism in action, Your Honor. I think that was a situation that was dealt with in a situation of being of fair play, that you can deal with this case as well. I think it is, again, I think there has to be a distinction here. The selling and assigning of a cause of action is something that's governed by statute. The regulation of trials afterwards, I have to admit to you, is something that is certainly for the courts.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I suspect the reason Mr. Keltner has noted what the practicing lawyers in the state of Texas have written on the subject of Mary Carter's is that he's putting in a plug for another one of his books that perhaps he's written. Mr. Keltner has done a fine job, as always, of drawing the issue in this case. It's true that the error that we're complaining of here is not the procedural error or the procedural measures which the court took. The objection that we've maintained throughout the trial was that there were no procedures whatsoever that the court could have adopted or implemented to eliminate all of the harm and prejudice that a Mary Carter situation causes in a trial. This is a public policy case. The respondent's entire defense of the judgment is based basically on the premise that there's a certain amount of courtroom distortion and skewed fact-finding that's inevitable in modern tort litigation today, and that defendants such as Dr. Elbar have no right to expect an ideally full and fair trial as long as there's evidence against that defendant, even if that evidence is sharply controverted.
Mr. Casey, even in a multi-defendant case, isn't there a natural incentive, absent any kind of settlement agreements, for one defendant under some circumstances to try to put off as much of the liability on a co-defendant? And why is that different from here?
Well, the main reason it's different here, Justice Cornyn, is the fact that the settling defendants, the defendants in this case who took that, allegedly took that posture, had absolutely no interest, justiciable interest in the case. Nobody was seeking any monetary recovery against them, and they had no claim against anyone else.
In other words, they had no risk whatsoever in this case, in this trial, and they could take whatever position they chose without that risk, which ordinarily is involved when a party chooses the strategy that they take in a trial. Counsel's argument that because the jury knew of the financial interest of the settling defendants ignores one important fact, and that is that that we all know, any of us that have tried lawsuits, that the jury typically does give a considerable amount of weight to the arguments the counsel make on the basis of the evidence and the tactics counsel uses. Simply to say that as long as there's evidence out there and as long as the jury is aware of the interest, that all's fair. I don't believe that that is comports with this court's responsibility to maintain a realistic yet high standards of fairness and integrity in trials. Dr. Elbar was required to make an objection to every form of prejudice that occurred in this trial, his trial counsel would have been on his feet literally every day, every moment of the four-week trial. There's just some prejudice which is inherent in these trials that no form of objection is going to cure, no form of instruction is going to cure. And that's why we have maintained that the court should declare Mary Carter agreements void. There are no procedural measures which a court can implement that would eliminate all of the harm. The court's already recognized the problems with Mary Carter's. The issue's been drawn.
How would you define a Mary Carter?
Well, Your Honor, we define Mary Carter. Of course, I think the court's going to be limited to the particular nature of the agreement in this case. But we would define a Mary Carter as any type of settlement in which a settling defendant gains if the plaintiff achieves a certain recovery against a non-settling defendant. That is the one trait in all Mary Carter agreements that's common. Does that answer your question?
You mean a monetary recoupment?
Yes, Your Honor. A gain or a credit against a judgment. We would ask the court to remand this case for another trial. Thank you for privilege being here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments and the foregoing causes, all of which are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
Please rise. Please.